Welcome to Trilawyer Talk. I'm Scott Glowski, and I'm your host for this podcast. We're going to talk to some of the best trial lawyers in the United States. We're going to talk to civil lawyers, criminal lawyers, jury consultants, and others that I think will have some interesting stories that are both entertaining and insightful. My goal here is to give you a view inside the hearts and the minds and the souls of great trial lawyers. We're not going to talk about the law, but I guarantee you that you'll learn a lot about trial through the stories that you're going to hear from our great guests. So I hope you enjoy the podcast. Let's get started. We are so fortunate today to have with us a phenomenal trial lawyer from Sacramento who is one of the most caring and giving people I know, let alone lawyers I know, who has a wonderful practice and does all kinds of personal injury work, as well as teaching lawyers around the country about how to try cases, Eric Ratanoff. Eric, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me, Scott. This is great.
Eric, can you tell us about a case that had a profound impact on you, either personally or professionally?
Yeah, you know, I have a number of cases that I think about over the years that have really affected me. And but one that really stands out is a medical malpractice case I had many years ago now that was in federal court. And it was long before we know nearly as much about AIDS as we do right now. But I represented the wife and the son of a man who was an AIDS patient, but he wasn't diagnosed with AIDS until autopsy. And the case was all about the failure of the medical system and his doctor in particular in identifying what was going on with him, diagnosing him, and getting the treatment that even back then was available to at least give him more time, if not save his life.
So tell us more about that.
Sure. So he was a relatively young guy, and he, you know, he's one of these guys who did odd jobs. And his background and how he probably ended up contracting the disease was years earlier. He had done some intravenous drugs. And, you know, back then it wasn't completely uncommon for people to get it through dental work. So that was one way that he could have gotten it. But probably it was because of some drug activity he had. And along the way he got married and he had a little boy. And he started feeling ill. And he was living in one of the foothill communities north of Sacramento. And he kept going back to the doctor, and he had strange blood work. And the doctor, the best that he was able to come up with for a diagnosis, believe it or not, was severe depression. Crazy diagnosis. Well, eventually, you know, my client's husband and client's father, this man, ends up in the hospital. And he dies because of his very serious illness. And again, it wasn't until he was diagnosed on autopsy that anyone even knew he had AIDS.
So how did you approach working on this case?
Well, at the time, it was actually a little bit scary because this was now close to 20 years ago. And so certainly there was plenty that was known about AIDS, but we've come a long way since then. And, you know, so it was really a matter of trying to understand what it was like, not only to maybe be an AIDS patient back then, but to understand what it meant to be in the medical profession and what was being offered and how to approach it and to try to come to some understanding as to what the medical profession had to offer and to find the experts that were out there and the experts that were out there. I mean, fortunately, living in Sacramento, we're not that far from San Francisco. And San Francisco was really ground zero for the AIDS epidemic in the U.S. And it was certainly ground zero for the sort of leadership in the medical thinking for AIDS and the treatment of AIDS. So I found a wonderful expert in San Francisco who really took me under his wing and gave me an opportunity to learn as much as I could about the disease and the epidemiology and why it was that this thing got missed as badly as it did.
Tell me more about what you did to understand both what it was like for a patient with AIDS back at that time, as well as for the physicians that were taking care of him.
You know, at the time I was, I turned 50 this year. So I was just in my early 30s at the time that I had this case. And, it was a strange feeling, but I was actually a little bit afraid of the case because it was so foreign and it was so strange. So I had to go through sort of a transformation in myself to be able to deal with the issues and to understand my own thoughts and feelings about it. And, you know, something that at the time, I mean, I didn't know anyone in my life who had been an intravenous drug user. I grew up in this community down here, Claremont, I was surrounded by people whose lives were as far from that as you can imagine. And so going up through school, and then suddenly I have this case that I'm dealing with. It was in federal court. It was foreign and it was scary, and I was dealing with my own thoughts and feelings about it and whether or not I was up to the task and how do I learn about all this stuff and how do I make people care about an AIDS patient at a time when there wasn't, in general, there wasn't a lot of caring so much as there was fear.
Tell me about your fears and the transformation you had to undergo.
You know, the fears were really just ignorance based, and what I discovered, and I had to in myself go through these same transformation that ultimately, if the case was tried, and it wasn't tried, ultimately we were able to get the case resolved for actually quite a bit of money, but the had I tried it, I would have had to bring the jury along through sort of the same journey that I went through. And that was to really overcome ignorance because it was the same ignorance that this doctor had who missed it. And it was the ignorance about what is AIDS, what does it mean to be an AIDS patient, and what is the dignity that everybody deserves, regardless of whatever stigma may be out there associated with any particular disease. And as the lawyer for this family, I had to go through all of that. Because when I started out in the case, I didn't know any of it. I didn't even realize how biased I was. I didn't realize how scared I was. And I really have to thank the great doctors that worked with me on the case to bring my level of understanding of the disease to the forefront, which then allowed me to approach the entire case and caring about this family in a way that came from a knowledge base, not a fear base, based on ignorance.
Well, tell us about your fears.
Well, my fears were that, this was a guy who had made certain life choices that made him ultimately responsible for the disease that ravaged his body and took him away from his wife and kid. And the reality is that while to a degree there may be some truth to that because he did make some bad life choices, the real truth of it was that this was a guy who had changed as a person, and he was a wonderful, loving father to this little boy,
and he was responsibly working, and he moved on with his life, and he was responsibly seeking medical care, and he was trying to get better, and the system failed him. The medical system failed him completely.
Where did you find, you know, the courage and the strength to not only recognize in yourself the bias that you had and, frankly, our culture had back in the late 80s, but also to be able to acknowledge that and deal with it and overcome it so that you could help this family?
You know, I think you're giving me too much credit by asking me where I found the courage and the strength, because I didn't. What I did do was I became educated about what was involved, and I really became ashamed of how wrong I was in terms of how I was viewing this man and viewing the choices he made and viewing what that meant in terms of what his life was all about and why his life had value and meaning. And so it's, I don't think anything I did in the case was ever came from a place of courage or strength. It really came from me coming to a greater understanding of who he was as a person and a greater understanding of what the disease was, and dealing with my own really my own shame at having been just sort of a biased jerk. And what I realized along the way was that I was no different when I was having those feelings. I was no different than the doctors and the medical system and all the people he had dealt with that he sought help from. And that, I think, is what ultimately turned the tide for me in the case, that allowed me to really shift my thinking on it and to approach the case from the standpoint really of love and caring, and not from the position of being just an ignorant, biased jerk.
Well, tell me more about that, how you approach the case from the standpoint of love and caring.
Well, what I did was once I did a tremendous amount of reading. I read all about communities of AIDS patients, and I read all about where people's where the disease takes hold in various communities throughout the U.S. And I studied the epidemiology, and I studied what was happening in terms of the development of treatment protocols. And, you know, at that point, AZT was just really starting to come up as a major possible hope for people. And there were battles that were being waged politically and economically in terms of who was going to be able to avail themselves of the treatment. Was it going to be covered by insurance? And who was going to have the hope of being able to extend their life? And so in the midst of all this, I just became a more educated person. And it's amazing how, you know, if you educate yourself, compassion doesn't come far behind.
And I know for many great lawyers, there's got to be some connection between the lawyer and the case emotionally to be able to throw yourself into it head over heels and take it on physically, emotionally, and tell the story. You know, was there something in that case that resonated with you?
Yeah, I mean, that was easy. I mean, he had a beautiful little boy who lost his dad. And so, you know, for me to emotionally connect to the case and my client, I didn't have to look any further than this child. And his mom was a terrific woman, you know, by now, I mean, somewhere along the line, perhaps she remarried, and maybe he did ultimately end up with a dad. But I mean, just cases involving kids who have lost their parents always eat me alive. They really do. And, you know, so any case I have that involves a child that's lost a parent is very, very close to my heart.
Can I ask you about your connection to this issue?
You know, I didn't lose my parents personally till fairly recently. And I don't know where that comes from. Well, I know where it comes from now because I have two kids. You know, the fear of my kids losing either me or my wife at a young age is pretty palpable. But back then, I didn't have kids. But it's something that's always it's always struck a chord with me in my practice, is that kids who lose their parents are clients that I very much take to heart.
You talk about approaching a case with love and caring. Well, what role does love and caring have in the courtroom?
You know, I don't really think that we can do our jobs as lawyers without getting the jury to feel love in that courtroom. You know, if we're going to be successful in what we do, you know, there are a couple of emotions that are huge, and they compete with each other, but they're not antagonistic towards each other. They're very complementary, and that's anger and love. I know in my own life experience, nobody has ever made me as angry as somebody who hurts somebody that I love. And there is nobody for whom I'm willing to forgive and forget about my anger than on behalf of somebody I love. And anger and love are very powerful emotions. And so, you know, whenever I have a case, I look for where those two emotions can come alive. And when I try a case, I try to find a place where those two emotions can come alive in the courtroom. A jury has to be able to experience the love that I have for my client, and the jury has to be able to experience its own love.
How do you do that?
Well, you do it by telling your client's story in a genuine, honest way that tells a story of loving relationships and the way those relationships have been affected either by the denial of the insurance policy or the injuries that have occurred or the fraud that's taken place, whatever it is, whatever your case may be about. Ultimately, every case is a human story, and human stories are guided by core emotions. And every case that we do, we have to be able to find our core emotional story that allows the jury to feel anger and allows the jury to feel love. And in every case that we do, we have to be able to bring those emotions to life through the telling of a story of trust and betrayal.
So how do you do that?
Well, the way you do it is you go through a process of working with your clients to discover their story and discover what it is that happened with them. In a medical malpractice case, if you're talking about a wrongful death case, I'll talk actually about a case I have coming up for trial that were set April 26 this year. And it's a young woman who fell into some bushes. She was taken to an emergency department. She had some blood trickling out of her ear, and the doctor just discharged her, didn't do any imaging, and ends up a few days later, she's found with a massive intracranial bleed, and she has a brain injury. So in that case, the story that we have to tell is a story of trust and betrayal, because she was you know, there's a very trusted relationship of doctor and patient that was betrayed. And it was, you know, we all trust our doctors to just do their job. And their job is to meet the standard of care. And in this situation, for whatever reason...
Tell us what the standard of care is.
Standard of care is just the rules, but honestly, it's just the rules that doctors need to follow to do their job right. You know, it's what is the minimum that we expect doctors to do to get their job done right. You know, and the standard of care is, I mean, it's defined as essentially what the reasonable physician in similar circumstances would do. But really what it is, it's what are the minimal expectations for you to do your job? And if you don't meet those, then you haven't done your job if you're the doctor. And it's not really that hard to do. But for whatever reason, this guy just didn't care. And he chose not to do his job. And we're never really going to know why, but he chose not to. And because of it, a young woman in her 30s now has a brain injury. Unfortunately, she's recovered tremendously from where she was at her worst, but she's going to continue to have problems for the rest of her life. And so as we, you know, as we tell the story of a trusted relationship, that's really intentionally broken for an improper purpose, that's betrayal. And so we figure out what in her story and what in the story of this medical visit at the emergency department helps us tell that story of the trusted relationship that's intentionally broken for an improper purpose. And she then heads out the door. And she, frankly, is never going to be the woman and live up to the potential that she had. And she had tremendous potential. But now she is a different version of herself. She's a new version of herself. And she's still going to go on in life to do some great things, I have no doubt. But her life has really been changed.
So how do you get your client to open up to you about her relationships and her loves and her fears and essentially to trust you with her deep emotions and that she probably doesn't want to tell anybody about?
You know, it's really fun. How do you do it? You just talk. And more importantly, you listen and you don't pretend to listen. I mean, you really truly listen to people. And, you know, Scott, you know, as well as anyone from the Trial Lawyers College, we learn all about how to listen, do a much better job at listening and truly listening to what's going on inside the person that they may not be sharing. And you help them along in that process. And you can roll reverse and you can double. And but most importantly, how do you do it? You sit down with your client, you go have a meal with them, you go to their home, you spend as much time as you can with them. And you just talk, and you talk about life, and you talk about yourself, you know. And sometimes clients are a little uncomfortable with that because a lot of people aren't honest with them about who they are and what their feelings are. And when I sit down and talk to my clients, I tell them everything, and I answer all their questions, and I volunteer a lot of information about myself, and I volunteer about my own fears and my own issues and my own problems. And
What do you tell your clients about your own fears and your own issues or problems?
Whatever happens to be true at the moment, you know, and, you know, that's one thing about our fears and our problems. They tend to shift, you know, and they change over time. And so, you know, if I've got a client who's dealing with a marital issue because of her injury, you know, I often talk to my clients about my own fears and anxieties in my own marriage or being a father or maybe not living up to my potential as a husband or a father. And I just, you know, it's there's none of it that's contrived. It's whatever feels true for me at the moment because first and foremost, this person I'm dealing with isn't a client. It's another human being. It's a person who's going through life struggles And the struggles that that person has today may not be the struggles they have a week from now. And they may be. I don't know. But, you know, when you're with somebody, if you can very quickly end up on the same wavelength talking to somebody about what's going on with them. And if you have open, honest communication with your client, just like if you have it with your husband or wife or your child, if you're having open, honest communication, you figure out what's making them tick. You figure out what's really going on inside them. So you can talk to them on a human level. And you're going to talk to them about what their fears are, what their hopes are, what their dreams are. And they're going to tell you. And if you're listening, if you're really listening, you're going to learn so much about who they are as people. And then, if you know truly who your client is as a person and what makes them tick, then you have an immense power in the courtroom to be able to bring that story alive. And the way that their injury or whatever event it is that you're dealing with in your case has affected and changed the fabric of their life and what it means for them as people trying to live their lives. And you're able to bring it out.
When you have a case where you're a month away from trial, this may be one example, where you've been living your client's story, learning your client's story, preparing, working for the last couple of years normally. What are you feeling at this point? You got a trial a month away.
Scared.
Tell me about that.
You know, I've never had a case where I didn't feel like I could be doing, I could have done more, or I could know my client better, or where I don't feel like I'm missing something. It's just part of my personality. I never, you know, if everything is going right and everything's lining up completely in our favor, well, then I'm still neurotic that I'm missing something. There's something that I haven't discovered yet. And then you get through trial and you realize you keep waiting for the other shoe to drop, and it never does. And so the last 30 days before trial, I have tremendous anxiety. I work really hard to make sure that I have all my ducks in a row so that I can present the case as well as humanly possible.
That sounds, in some ways, exhausting.
Yes, it is exhausting, but it's fun.
How do you deal with it? I mean, obviously, it's stressful.
Yeah.
How do you deal with the stress?
You know, the only way that I've been able to figure out to deal with the stress is literally work every waking moment. And so if I know that I'm doing everything that I can possibly be doing, it just happens to be less stressful for me. You know, stress, I feel stress in those moments where I'm not working, which may not be the healthiest way to live, but that's when I feel stress. When I'm actually doing the work and accomplishing it and getting it done, to me, that's not stressful.
Earlier, you talked about the case where you represented the family of this young man with AIDS. How did that have a profound impact on you?
You know, I think the biggest impact on me in that case and why I often think about it is it was just a case where I learned a lot about myself and my own vulnerabilities as a person and my own biases and prejudices and my own fears as a lawyer in terms of wondering whether or not I was up to the task and learning about setting aside my own ignorance and my own bias, educating myself, and really drilling down to the core emotional truth in the story and keeping my focus there. And so then not only did the way in which I handled that case changed, I changed as a person. And after handling that case, I've never been the same person, and I've never been the same lawyer.
How so?
Well, for the things that we were talking about earlier, I forced myself to confront my own ignorance and my own bias and my own fear. And it was fear based in ignorance and bias. And once I got through that experience, I realized, you know, it wasn't a case about a guy who had made life choices that were perhaps poor, who ended up with a disease that a lot of people would blame him for getting because of his poor life choices. It was a case about a beautiful little boy who was going to grow up without a dad because his doctor didn't do his job. And that was a huge shift. And it was a shift that I went through as a person. And it's a shift that I carry with me and probably will for the rest of my career.
Now, have you ever heard from that family over the last 20 years after you handled the case?
You know, I haven't. I have not. But that's okay. I trust and I believe that that little boy has now grown up into a terrific young man who's moving forward in his life, who I know for a fact had his college paid for if he went up through the ranks of school and got accepted to college.
How does that make you feel to know that you have worked on a case where it's obvious to me how much you love this little boy and that you had an impact on him and his future?
I love it. It's the best part of our job, knowing that we can take a tragedy and turn it in, at least turn it into some form of economic hope for people. And it's not just the economics, it's what the economics represent. I mean, money is just a representation of value. And the value is all those great things in people's lives that they have some degree of economic freedom to take advantage of. And it's great. Knowing that this little child got to grow up and become educated because of my hard work, it was, I love it.
You mentioned the best part of our job. What's the worst part of our job?
The worst part of our job is, I have to say, it's probably the level of dishonesty that I deal with people. I've never gotten used to being lied to, and it always, always hurts me. I am one of those people who tends to give others the benefit of the doubt. And I learned that lesson the hard way over and over again. But I can't break myself of that. It's too much a part of who I am. I get along with people very well, and I love people. But to me, the most disappointing thing about what we do is the degree to which, you know, people lie. And whether it's opposing counsel or parties or the people involved in cases, there is a disease in our country that involves a lack of integrity that has become very acceptable to large groups of people. Now, the good news is the vast majority of people don't fall into that category. Most people I deal with are honest, and most people do have integrity. But there are certainly some bad apples out there. Now, you asked what was the worst part? I think that's the worst part.
What are three words that your best friend would use to describe you?
Probably caring, loving, and loyal.
What are three words that the most obnoxious, contentious lawyer on another side of a case would use to describe you?
Probably prepared, fearless, and slippery.
What does slippery mean?
I think a lot of times that they don't see it coming, what I'm intending to do.
You mean your story that you're going to tell?
The story that's going to be told, the way it's going to be told.
What was your proudest moment as a trial lawyer?
The proudest moment as a trial lawyer was probably I don't really have one. But I tried a case a few years back with co-counsel. It was a medical malpractice case, and a big issue in the case was the comparative fault of this young girl's parents. And I'm without going into all the details of the case, there was probably the once we got over breach of the standard of care, the next biggest issue in the case was overcoming the notion that ultimately what happened to this young person was the parents' fault for not bringing their child back to the doctor over the course of years. And despite many referrals to the doctor, and there was a failure of follow-up. I did a soft cross of the key defense witness that the defense just never saw coming.
Can you share with us what a soft cross is?
So a soft cross was really, rather than attacking the witness, it was using the witness as to this defense retained neurologist. Rather than talking about the neurology, I just led him through a cross that absolved the child's parents of almost all blameworthiness for not bringing her back to the doctor. And we never talked about neurology for even a moment during the cross. And the cross was over before they knew it. And the defense lawyer got up and literally stuttered, didn't know what his first question was going to be. Did a couple of little questions and then sat back down and he was done. And the jury came back, and they did hit the parents with a small percentage of fault. But it was that cross-examination that completely opened up the case to what ended up being a really wonderful verdict.
Why was that your proudest moment?
Because it was a moment where rather than having a focus be on yet another lawyer just taking on another witness and trying to win the battle of that witness, just setting all of that aside and really focusing on the story and what the role of that witness could potentially be in the story. Not as a doctor who was taking a position, but as ultimately he ended up as a neurologist, while hired by the defense to do the defense's dirty work, he really was on the witness stand as a parent who could fully understand why the parents failed reasonably to do their job as parents when it came to seeking medical care. And to give life to why a parent might do that, and that would be okay.
I also have the sense that there was something going on in you about the message that you were conveying to the parents through that cross-examination. Does that
that was at all? That was hugely important to me. Being able to give that gift to those parents, and because even though we had never actually had the conversation, where I would just tell them outright, it's not your fault, it's not your fault, because you can't say that. I mean, you can say it, I guess, but nobody's, if you're a parent, you're not going to believe it, because as a parent, and you're looking from this end of the equation instead of the front end, and you know that the damage has already occurred, and your beautiful child is going to have a horrible time for many years to come. And as a parent, there's no way you don't question it, and you don't question what you did, and you don't question your decisions. And so there was nothing that I could say as a lawyer that would make that better for them. The ability for them to sit in the courtroom and watch that unfold and have even this hired defense gun tell it the way it was, and to be able to say from the witness stand that he completely understands why they did what they did was huge. And the ability for that to have happened in that way so that they could genuinely hear it and feel it and know it, and then have the jury come back and say they heard it too, was huge.
Can you tell us what that story was, or just give us a little picture of how that story played out?
Sure. In terms of what actually happened
in the cross examination with that witness.
So it was a child who, when she was 13 years old, was diagnosed with Guillain-Barré, which is they believe it's a neuromuscular condition that's they believe is related to it gets triggered by viral illness, and it's really a and it's horrible. And anyway, so when she was 13 years old, she temporarily lost the ability to walk. She went to a local medical center where she was diagnosed, and they did some imaging. And the case ended up being about them missing something on that imaging. But they got her back walking. And she was discharged with a very strict instructions to bring her back for follow-up evaluation and care with the chief of pediatric neurology for the entire system, who had taken this child under his wing. Well, the parents never brought her back. They did take her to the pediatrician, though, and the pediatrician wrote another thing for the child to go back for follow-up. With this preeminent pediatric neurologist, and they still didn't take her back. Well, when she was 18, that thing that showed up in the imaging reared its ugly head, and she ended up paralyzed. And a lot of the defense case was that had the parents just brought her back for follow-up care over the years the way they were supposed to, that there no doubt would have been further imaging along the way because the child continued to have difficulties, serious difficulties. And so there was a big belief on the defense side of the case that the jury ultimately was just going to blame the parents. And the cross-examination of this doctor, which probably only lasted a couple of minutes, I just walked him through that time period, that 5 years, through the parents' eyes. And I asked him to imagine that he was there and imagine that the parents were discharged with their little child with a diagnosis of Guillain-Barré. And then she goes on and she goes to a pediatrician who then tells the parents that she has Guillain-Barré, and the pediatrician and the medical facility all wanted her to follow up for Guillain-Barré. And that as the years rolled up by, she needed assistance in school, getting from class to class because of her diagnosis of Guillain-Barré. And so, doctor, can you understand why it is that for 5 years, the parents believed wholeheartedly that what their daughter had was Guillain-Barré? And his answer, of course, was yes. And it was a really simple cross-examination that just walked through that entire period of care. And I left everything else in the case alone.
And ultimately, she was diagnosed with something other than Guillain-Barré.
Yeah, ultimately, she was diagnosed with, she had an arteriovenous malformation that was in her spine that ultimately ruptured and paralyzed her.
Wow. Well, what amazing work. I'm very thankful, Eric, that you took the time to chat with us today and share your great insights about how you approach cases, how you care about clients, and how you fight for people that don't have anyone to fight for them. So thank you very much for spending time with us, and thanks for fighting for your clients, and your clients are very, very lucky to have you as their lawyer.
Thanks, Scott.
Thank you for joining us today for Trial Lawyer Talk. If you like the show, I'd really appreciate it if you could give us a good review on iTunes, and I'd love to get your feedback. You can reach me at www.scottglovsky.com. That's scottglovsky.com. And I'd love to hear your feedback. You can also check out the book that I published called Fighting Health Insurance Denials, A Primer for Lawyers. That's on Amazon. I put the book together based on 20 years of suing health insurance companies for denying medical care to people, and it provides a general outline of how to fight health insurance denials. Have a great week, and we'll talk to you in the next episode.